It's the Barry Pod on 99.3 thevine.com.
This is the Barry Pod. This episode was recorded on the 4th of October, 2023. In the pod this time is Antonia Landles.
Hello. Hello, hello.
Thanks for being on the Barry Pod, or in the Barry Pod. We're in it and we're on it at the same time.
I love it. Thank you for having me.
You bet. The Sex Ed Education Project is what we're going to talk about. But before we get into the nuts and bolts of that, you are a sex education educator.
Yep.
How did you get into that line of work?
That's a great question. Thank you for asking. The Sex Ed Justice Project is the organization I help co-found. And I have been doing sex ed since I was 12, I think. So this is my life.
Wait a second.
There's always some questions. Yeah. Right.
That brings up the obvious question. How do you start doing sex ed when you're 12?
So I don't know if you noticed from the radio, but I do talk fairly fast. So somehow I talked my teachers into at the River School and went there the very first 3 years it opened. There was a class I did not want to take. And I talked them into letting me leave the campus and walk down the street to the Napa Valley AIDS Project. And I grew up in San Francisco. I grew up with a lot of folks I knew who were HIV positive. And it was something that had always been a part of my life. And a person who helped raise me when I was very young died from HIV. And so for part of it is really, I had such an amazing childhood filled with so much warmth and love and laughter and was so wonderful to me that this was sort of how I was able to pay my respects to the people that raised me. And it's always been something I've been comfortable talking about. It's in my veins. It's my soul. It's my passion. I incorporate it into everything I do. For Halloween, I'm always something sexual health related. This year, I'm going to be an egg. My dog is going to be the sperm. One year, like, I was the vulva. He was the vagina. Like, I mean, we're always something sexual health related. So my pumpkins during Halloween have, like, a sperm or a uterus on them, you know? So my Halloween, you know, lights or Christmas lights will say, like, use condoms or be a uterus. So it's something that is so close to me and so important, and I can't imagine my life without it.
I like to think that we're gradually becoming more comfortable with physical bodies, sexuality, less Puritan, I guess, is the thing. And because there's a feeling, an attitude, an idea that Americans' repressiveness stems from
Puritan
yep. origins. True or false, is that who we are as a people?
So I think that over the history, we've gone through many, you know, iterations of this, right? There's been times of sexual liberation and there's been times of sexual repression. And I think that right now we are very much entering a space and time where there's a lot of sexual repression. And the more that we are able to have open and frank conversations about this, the better and healthier we can be. So I think that if you just think about just two sort of things, if you think about sex and all of the sports analogies that surround the way that we talk about sex, right, using them as metaphors, you know, playing, you know, batting for the other team or hitting, you know, going to home base, there's so many sports metaphors. And by doing that, we're setting up two people on opposing teams, right? Which means in sports, there's always one team that wins, which means there's always one team that loses. And so if we are able to shift the way that we talk about sex, and there's a great sex educator named Al Vernaccio who uses a sex and pizza analogy. And instead of sports analogies, replacing it with pizza analogies, where when you eat pizza, you eat because you're hungry. It's an internal desire that you think about. And there are thousands of ways to eat pizza. None of them are wrong. They're different, but they're not wrong. And you stop eating pizza when you're full. And it's something that you engage in together. And the first thing you do when you order pizza, even if you've ordered pizza with someone for a long time, is ask them, should we still get the usual? There's a conversation about what you want first, right? And so I think that if we're able to switch the way that we talk about sex in our communities and in our country to a much more holistic wraparound and consent-based, you know, space, it will only do us good and will only bring healthier young people and adults.
Hmm. I'm picturing a conversation about maybe a little suspicious. When did you start liking Chicago style pizza? Where did that come from? You didn't get that from me.
Well, those, you know, that doesn't necessarily, isn't as important as when was the last time you were tested for Chicago pizza, you know? Because that relates to my health for sure. And so, yeah, but like, I think that I do a whole activity using, I have students basically work with another student or two other students to create the pizza of their dreams. This is also, you know, shout out to any pizza companies that want to give out free pizza, because I always feel bad at the end being like, we're not ordering these. And the kids are like sad. But using those skills to order a pizza is a way that they are using those consent skills, right? So they're like, and it's not about like, oh, I don't like ham, but you like ham, so now I have to have ham on my pizza and give up something I don't like just because you like it. It's like, no, have ham on half, not on the other half. Everybody can be excited. You know, oh, you like pineapple? I don't. Pineapple is very divisive when it comes to pizza. Right, it's very divisive.
But not when it comes to sex.
Now, right. And so just finding places where people share interests and share things that they like, as opposed to having it be one-sided, right? And having those conversations in a way that brings intimacy and connection and health.
So what's the appropriate age as parents for us to be thinking that this is when my child needs to know some basic things about what they are inherently feeling, naturally already feeling, and maybe starting to express in different ways? And I'm thinking about, you know, the fact that we have urges, maybe is the right word, and maybe emotions is the other word, urges and emotions, before we're able to identify what they are or to have any idea of whether to act on them or not, or, you know,
Harry, I still have emotions I can't identify and whether to act on them or not. That's true for me, and I'm 40. Yeah, so, right? Yeah.
Instinctiveness. There's instinctiveness that we don't know what to do with. And that starts very, very young. So when should a parent be saying, this is a point where some conversation needs to happen or some book needs to be read or something?
So I used to be terrified to talk to parents because I wasn't a parent. And so I was always terrified that I'm like, they're going to know. And now parents are my favorite group of people to talk to because they still need support around all this. Parents have a history as well, and they have maybe trauma that they've experienced. And I do a group with a Waldorf school here in town. And it happens outside of the school. We do 2 hours every week for 16 weeks. And the first thing I do with the parents is I ask them to think about the first time that they got those butterflies in their stomach and they felt like, ooh, I like this person. And, you know, and just write one or two sentences about it and the age at which it happened. And then I ask them on a different colored note to write about the first time they felt like hurt inside. That first time that was like not just a friend not liking them, but somebody, maybe something more. And then we put them up on the wall according to age. And when you step back and look at the visual, you see a lot of things happening between the ages of 12 and like 15 or 16. There's some outliers, sure. There's some that maybe happened at 25 or some that happened much earlier. But there's a lot going on right around that area and that time period. That doesn't mean that you don't want to start early. We like to say talk early, talk often. When kids are little, use the correct terms for their body. And when I say correct, lots of different communities have different ideas of what correct means, right? So don't use shame. Like when a little kid touches their genitals in public, the first thing parents say is nops or is stop, don't, you know, don't do that. And that creates this like connection between our brain and our genitals of this negativity, right? So we like to talk to parents about, talk about private versus public, right? Say, hey, that's more for private time. That way we're not shaming kids. So when you start these conversations, it's not just a one and done conversation. It's an ongoing conversation that happens. And there's a great resource that I like to refer folks to that's called sexpositivefamilies.org. And they can basically, they have a drop-down menu there where you can select your child's age and then even the topic and the medium at which you'd like to get information, either books or websites or games. And they have an amazing, massive resource for parents that is really, really comprehensive and great. My best friend, when she got pregnant, I got her, when her baby was born, I got them, you know, C is for consent book. So that we talk about these things early, you know. Kids, I'm not saying like consent isn't, if you're asking your kid to go clean the room and they say no, like that's not consent. But if you're tickling them and they say no, stop, you show them respect for that and immediately be like, okay. so that they know that that word should be respected, and they know that if they say it, it is respected, right? And that bodily autonomy, not making little kids go hug their aunt if they don't want to, that's okay. You know, they are in charge of their own body, and ensuring that they see that that word is respected when they say it, and they also know that it should be respected when someone says it to them. So we say talk early, talk often, and parents don't have to have all the answers. That's okay. It can be really, really overwhelming. So the little tips I usually give parents are use the car. The car is a really important, vital time to talk to your young person for a couple reasons. One is you are not sitting staring at each other opposing, right? So you're not like set up on these opposing sides. You're aligned together usually, right? You also don't have to have eye contact, and that young person might be more comfortable being a little bit more vulnerable because they know that that conversation has an ending, because they know they know that they're going to get somewhere and they can get out of the car and the conversation will end, which gives them a little bit more power. Mm-hmm. So anytime we can give young people power is really important. The other last thing I'll say for parents is when your kids ask you questions, they might ask you questions that you have no idea what the answer is. It's totally okay. Really memorize and learn the soundbite. That's a great question. Thank you so much for asking. And then you can say, let's go look that up together so that you can help direct them to like a resource that is reliable and valid and not just send them to the internet, which is a sea of who knows what. Or you can say, can I get back to you after I think about that a little bit? And give you some time to think about that so that in your mind you can freak out and have all those, you know, reactions that you want to have, but that you're really welcoming your young person to ask you questions so that when they're older and they maybe really need you, you've set that foundation work in there and they will come to you.
I reflect often on what would be my sex education as a child, and it wasn't the talk, but I think this was planned. My parents, who belonged to the Book of the Month Club, ordered the book, Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex But Were Afraid to ask, right? Mm-hmm. From the 60s, 70s.
It's still in print. It's a good one, yeah.
Sure. And thinking this through, you know, you think about things as an adult that happen when you're a child and suddenly you discover, oh, wait a minute, you know, that moment. Why would my adult parents in their 40s have wanted to have that book? I don't think they needed to learn anything about sex at that point, right?
Great question.
But, you know, it came in the mail or whatever, and they put it on the shelf, and it was a shelf in the living room that where all the other Book of the Month Club books and the encyclopedias were. And I was a voracious reader from the time
Mom's an English teacher. I love it. Yep.
So I'm going to read anything that's on that shelf. And so I came across that when I was 10, 11, maybe. And I read that whole book. I might have read that book twice. It was fascinating.
Yeah.
And the way it was so straightforward, and it had a little bit of a a little bit of a grin. It wasn't serious. Yep. It wasn't like this is rocket science. And so, you know, you read Everything You Always Wanted to Know About Sex We're Afraid to Ask. You know a lot at age 10 or 11. And I think this must have been a plan so they would not have to have the talk. There was no such thing as sex education in a school where I grew up, when I grew up.
Yeah.
Pretty brilliant, don't you think?
So you touched on a couple different topics, pun intended there. I think that also limiting to a conversation to just that one, the talk, can be really, we have to sort of figure out new language because we don't want it to be a one and done. This needs to be a conversation that happens over a long period of time. Also, I love that your parents, so like they put it, that book out there, like it was nothing different. And I think that is such a subtle, nuanced, vital, important aspect that happened because they just made it like something else. We tend to think of sex as something so separate and so different. And by othering it, we're eliminating it from our scope of what we talk about and think about every day, right? The other thing is that I think that I love that when you were 10 or 11, you just were in like soaked up all of that information, right? And I think what's really important for folks to know is that when we're going in and talking to young people, it's developmentally appropriate and information. We're not going in and talking to these like little kids about things that, you know, are not developmentally appropriate for them, right? And so I think that really thinking about when we're talking to kids about sex early, we're not actually talking about the nuts and bolts of sex. We're not talking about the activities. We're laying those other foundational skills that young people need to learn to talk about, like, you know, love, talking about feelings, how to deal with them. And so I love that your parents left that book out there that gave you the basic information, the facts, right? The science information. But they probably, I would bet, supported that book in other ways by talking to you about other things outside of that book that were like more soft core skills, more skills like, how do you talk to a friend? What do you do when you're upset and they hurt you and they break your trust? You know, how do you earn that trust back? And thinking about those other sort of qualities and skills that we need to navigate when we're younger, because we might navigate that in a personal relationship. But they gave you the facts right there in the book, which is really wonderful. And then I bet probably supported you in other ways to talk about those other bigger feelings things.
Yeah, maybe. Not sure about that part. Different generation.
Well, absolutely, absolutely. Yeah, but you know, we want, I run a group with the same Waldorf school where every week I send the kids home with a puzzle piece that has a question on it and a magnet on the back. So they have to ask their parents this question. And it's things like, what do you do when someone breaks your trust? You know, how do you know when you're in love? How do you know when you're out of love? And these are questions that are not, they don't have anything you can look up or Google on the internet. They're not going to be in that book. You know, like they might talk about them, but there's not one right or wrong answer. But it really, really instills that parent-child communication and building that so that you can help, you know, your young person build those healthy relationships as they grow.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about pornography. The world has changed so much in so many ways, but I sometimes think maybe access to pornography is one of the most significant changes of the last, say, 20, 30 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's been around for much longer than that. Think of cave drawings,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Access to. Yep. Presence of one thing, but access to is another.
Absolutely.
You know, I'm going to be confessional about my childhood. We had, you know, a hidden Playboy magazine.
Absolutely.
And the other two or three guys in the neighborhood my age, that was all we had to, you know, we're not learning anything from that, really. Being titillated by it, being, enticed by it, but not learning anything. But today, and there's lots of studies, as you know, and this is your field, that kids of unbelievably young ages have an awareness of sexual behaviors that
come with no context.
No context.
Yep.
And it's just astonishing how much kids know and are seeing and are aware of. So it must be extremely difficult to create an educational framework when you don't really know how much of this sort of pollution.
We know. So okay. One of the things that I always, I hate to tell parents, but I'm just like, you know, when I talk to them and I'm like, does your, you know, young person have a phone? And if they say yes, I'm like, they've seen porn. And then parents are always like, no, my kid is really, I'm like, nope, they've seen porn. Even if it's just one little thing, and I'm going to go with like, if I was a betting person, I would always bet on the fact that they had seen it rather than they hadn't, regardless of what their kid or how naive or sheltered or, you know, like uncomfortable with that stuff. Even if they're uncomfortable with it, they still might have Googled it to then find out that they are uncomfortable with it, right? Mm-hmm. And so porn cannot be their only source of information. And I don't even think on some places you have to even click that you're 18 anymore. You know what I mean? So it is so accessible. You can put in all of the parental guidance that you can on their phone. And let me tell you, when I go to a school and I'm trying to show a video about like, you know, about bodies, you know, just to like different bodies that are drawings or whatever, and I'm blocked in the school website, let me tell you, who's the first people to help me figure out a way to get around that ad blocking or that, you know, censoring? It's the students. So you can put as much out there as you want to try to protect them from that information. But this is the other thing. I do not believe in being a gatekeeper of information from young people. I don't believe in being the person that I'm holding all this information and I'm only going to give it to you when I want to, and really gatekeeping that. I think that porn is a way for us to start having these conversations in a better way, because that being their only source is not healthy. I will like shout out to New Zealand here, because New Zealand does an amazing job and has amazing curriculum about how porn and young people are interacting. They have this great ad where these two porn stars like show up in this person's house and they're like, wait, this can't be their only source of information. They need to talk to like a parent about this, you know? And it's really great, because I think it's really looking at the fact that we need to start understanding that if they have a cell phone, or as my friend Louise says, a rectangle, that they're accessing this information, whether it be frequently, whether it be once, whether it be every day. But we need to counteract that with more information. We need to counteract that with, just like movies and just like romantic comedies are not realistic depictions of real relationships, pornography is not real depictions of sex. And there tends to be a very mainstream view of like of sex. And I remember a sex educator told me one time, if you're not a porn search category, you have privilege. And there are so many, like almost everyone except for almost like, you know, like straight white cisgendered males are like porn search categories. And so thinking about how pervasive it is and how much we really need to have deeper conversations about young people, about all the things that are happening behind those scenes that we're not seeing. It's a movie. It's produced. It's meant to be, you know, a highly stylized movie. It's not going to be accurate depictions. And so really making sure that we're talking to young people about it. And just because it's porn and they're not 18 doesn't mean they're not seeing it, right? So talking about porn in schools is always a little scary. People get really nervous because they're not, and we have a frank conversation with young people. I say to them, like, you know, I really want to reiterate that pornography is only legal for people who are 18 and over. I really want to make sure that we understand and that that is a legality here. But does that mean that people haven't seen it? You know what I mean? And recognizing that that is both things can coexist and are true. And if we don't talk about it, we are doing a massive disservice to our young people. Yeah.
Speeding is illegal too, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And very good point. Yes.
Antonia Landles has been a sex educator since you were 12, yeah. You told us, which is fascinating in and of itself. But today you are running something called the Sex Ed Education.
The Sex Ed Justice Project.
Sex Ed Justice Project, yeah. Excuse me. And I can't even write that down correctly, apparently. What is the Sex Ed Justice Project and why is it important?
So this is an organization that was co-founded by me and three other amazing, phenomenal human beings that I am so fortunate and lucky to work with, and who have challenged me in ways that I had not been challenged yet and have taught me things along the way. Like I get so emotional talking about it just because we've created these relationships that are so, I value so much. And basically it is a homegrown, even though one of our co-founders is in Seattle, she used to live here. Her mom used to live here too. And she jumped back on the, on our planning here. And basically we are an organization that values sex education. And we found that all of a sudden Northern California had this massive need for sex ed because a primary deliverable of that service had been this organization that had since, you know, diverted their focus. All due to the Dobbs decision, right? All due to Dobbs decision. So we got together and we're like, hey, we could actually fill this void. We could fill this gap. And because education is so important, there was at the health center I used to work at, there was a study done a couple, you know, maybe like 10 years ago, and we surveyed the people coming into the health center, and over 70% of the clients in Napa were there because they had seen an educator. So it's so, so, so vital that people are getting this information, they're getting the education, and they're also able to identify like a trusted adult that they can talk to. I can't tell you how many times after classes, young people come up to me and ask me questions. I do anonymous questions with students where they write, you know, things anonymously. And I keep this one on my refrigerator because it asks a basic question about sex ed. And then in parentheses, it says, I trust you a lot. And I keep it on my fridge because I want to be reminded every single day that I'm going into these spaces and into these classrooms, maybe for a week or shorter or whatever, but that I immediately am creating this trust with young people that they value and that they see. And I really honor that. And so the Just Sex Ed Justice Project does that. We provide this education, and we also are helping train teachers and medical professionals so that they can provide this information to their young people in a sustainable way, because it is so nuanced.
And so you're working as a contractor in schools?
Yes. So we actually had our first intern. Like, we were having so many firsts as an organization, and you know, I had no idea how to start a nonprofit when I started this. And we all have such complementary skills that we've been able to really pull it through, and now have fiscal sponsorship through the San Francisco Public Health Foundation. and we have a website and we have an Instagram, and we're really becoming, it feels like we're growing up as in an organization, and we are doing it very, very mindfully. So we want to make sure that we are talking to folks in the community, that we have young people's voices heard and valued, and that we are creating spaces to where we are being intentional and mindful about every step we take, right? We're doing collaboration, not competition, and we are ensuring that we are community-based and really, really making a very, very intentional steps. You know, I think that starting this organization has been profound for me, because there were some things that were really important that I couldn't, you know, always talk about with my other work. And, you know, talking about pleasure and sex is so important. It really, really is, because one of the primary reasons people engage in sex is not to always have a pregnancy, but because it feels good, right?
What?
Yeah, I know. And if we're not talking about, or at least mentioning pleasure with young people, like, we're not being honest, you know? And I think that discussing pleasure is so important when we're talking about sex ed. And this organization really acknowledges that. And it's not like we're going in and being like, hey, you know, but we're acknowledging that pleasure exists. And it's a reason people have sex, because we're not gatekeepers and we're not there to decide what information they should get or should not get.
And, you know, I don't want to make an equivalency, but it reminded me of how what a failure drug policies have been when that part is ignored. The fact that whether it's nicotine or alcohol or something else, it changes the way you feel. And that's why people do it. And that's what can lead to a problem, then, right? If you can't control that desire to feel good, which, you know, can also be sex addiction, right? So it's really all the same thing. But it's that trying to pretend like, you know, oh, a drug addict's life is nothing but miserable. Yeah, except when they're high, and that's when they feel good. And that's what you're skipping over.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly. And so I really having frank conversations with young people is builds trust, right? And I think that if we're able to do that, then we can't, you know, we're acknowledging what's existing in the world. And also, information is always changing. Mm-hmm. It's always evolving. We need to ensure that we're inclusive, that we're representative of the communities, that people can come into a sex ed classroom and be like, oh, they see me. You know, I'm seen here. I'm valid. Who I am matters, you know? And I had an amazing educator who I worked with for a very long time, E.B. Trost, who died 2 years ago, very suddenly and tragically. Well, she was 20 weeks pregnant. And part of me, she was such a brilliant sex educator and had so many wonderful sound bites. And so she wrote the San Francisco, you know, Unified School District sex ed curriculum. She was a phenomenal, phenomenal, amazing educator. So part of what I'm hoping to do with this organization is really taking that sort of way in which EB did education and that mindset of and you mentioned earlier, I wanted to touch back on this too, how your parents gave you that book that had some sort of grin and was smiling,
they didn't
you know?
Give it to me.
Well,
they
just left it there. And that was another point that I wanted to address, in that when we bring humor to talking about sexual health, it allows a space for everyone to come to the table, because many people have experienced trauma and they've experienced things that are not okay. And if we're able to make it in a way that is fun and funny and lighthearted, we can bring everyone to the table to like have a conversation that feels safe, that's trauma informed, and puts them at the center so that they can make those decisions and those choices. And I've been, like I said, I've been doing sex ed since I was 12. I'm 40. I've had one person only ever once, you know, leave a classroom because it was too intense and emotional for them. One person. And I do about 5 groups a day every day.
Wow.
So by using humor, we can laugh together. We're not laughing at someone, but we can laugh together. Like, I'm sorry, but the word balls is very funny. It's a very funny word. And so it's why I talk about anatomy the first day. But if we can laugh at things and have a good time together, that instills that feeling that we can all be, you know, create community and share in this together and build those healthy skills.
And as a final thought, speaking about laughing about things, I mentioned the name of the book, but the movie that goes by that name is not the same as the book. The Woody Allen made it into a very silly movie, which is entertaining, but it's the book was not that. Just in case you've seen the movie and wonder, was that the book that Barry read when he was a kid? No, it's very different. We've run out of time. We could probably talk all day. It's a great topic and very interesting. Before we wrap, though, how can someone find out more about the Sex Ed Justice Project?
Absolutely. So they can check us out on Instagram at the Sex Ed Justice Project. Or me, I'm Glitter Sex Ed, because I like to glitter things. Some glitter sex ed. They can look us up on our website, which is thesexedjusticeproject.org. And please feel free to reach out. We are a new organization. So if you want to support us, please reach out to us. We are like looking for help and expertise in so many different areas. If you want to, you know, support us financially, we are super and always happy to accept donations. We are a 501c3 nonprofit, so they are tax deductible. And we are really looking to the community to help, you know, guide us and to really have a voice in this organization. So please reach out in any way you're interested in being involved.
River School graduate, yes. Antonia Landles has been our guest here on the Berry Pod. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me. I so appreciate this.
This episode of the Berry Pod recorded on October 4th, 2023.
You're listening to the Berry Pod, tastings from Wine Country Live in the morning.
On 99.3, thevine.com.